Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my coat.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is Senator Ron Wyden, author of the new book, It Takes Chutzpah. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We're in the period of the Jewish calendar in which we read the first sections of the Book of Exodus, which tells the great tale of our people's enslavement and liberation in ancient Egypt. It's the most significant narrative in all of Jewish history, this famous tale of persecution, struggle, and freedom. In fact, the Exodus from Egypt is cited so frequently in Jewish prayer and study that it can be seen as the central Jewish story. We include passages about the Exodus in every single religious service, morning and evening, every day. We refer to it when we say the Kiddush, the prayer of sanctification over wine, every Shabbat and festival. You know, it's a fascinating aspect of Judaism that we focus so much on the fact that our ancestors were slaves, the lowest of the low in any society. So many people celebrate their noble ancestry, their descent from high-born people or even actual gods. For example, the Emperor of Japan was quite literally believed to have been a descendant of the sun itself. The pharaohs of ancient Egypt, our enslavers, considered themselves to be divine, gods on earth descended from the gods. Greek kings and Roman emperors claimed similar highest possible ancestry, but not the Jews. In fact, we make it a point to say, Avadim hayinu lefaro b'mitzrayim, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. We had nothing of our own, no status at all. We were, in that materially advanced but morally stratified ancient Egyptian society, akin to untouchables. And in our retelling of this tale, we don't hide that. Instead, we remember our origins and where we came from insistently. We weren't born with silver spoons in our mouths, but among the hardworking and the lowly of the earth. We Jews were slaves. And God, through Moses, brought us out to freedom. And it was not the last time we were enslaved. In fact, oppression and even servitude have been our fate as Jews in many of the centuries since that original burst into freedom we will read about in the synagogue over these 3 weeks in the book of Exodus. It should be no surprise to find that we Jews identify, then, with the downtrodden of society, the poor, the dispossessed, the immigrants, far more than the powerful and the dominant. Even when we have transcended bigotry and prejudice to rise high in society, it is the Jewish perspective to seek to help those who have less. As we read these familiar passages of Torah, about slavery, plagues, liberation, and redemption, this week and over the next few weeks, we might consider another idea central to Jewish thinking. It is that concept that time can transform curses into blessings, that struggling up from suffering and the struggle to achieve meaningful ideals, to seek something better, well, that's a powerful and important process. What begins as a curse in Exodus, the persecution and enslavement, even the attempted genocide of the Israelites, eventually leads to a tremendously powerful experience of growth, belief, moral greatness. Without that journey down to Egyptian slavery, we probably don't forge a true identity as a people. Without the dramatic events of the plagues and the Exodus, we don't discover the central truth of the oneness and power of God. Without a flight in haste from a land we've lived in for over 400 years, we don't come to Mount Sinai or receive the Ten Commandments. And without all that struggle, we don't come to value the centrality of a central moral code that creates an ethical imperative to strive to be a nation of priests and a holy people, dedicated to living good lives that improve the world. You know, it's nearly a platitude, but it happens to be true. It's not the events around us that shape the world. It's how we respond to those challenges, how we take the pain and transform it into learning and a passion for meaning. This has been a traumatic couple of years for Jews, both in Israel and America and all around the world. The only Jewish nation on the planet, Israel, is emerging now, we pray, from some of the worst times in its recent history. Anti-Semitism's on the upswing all around the globe in a way we haven't seen in generations. American Jewry is struggling with issues of assimilation and doubt, feeling both persecuted for its identity while simultaneously appearing more and more indifferent to Jewish practice and prayer. And yet we know that in every seeming crisis there can be great opportunity. If our ancestors could grow from being slaves to becoming an Am Kadosh, a holy nation, well, we too can find our own way to greatness yet again. Now, American Jewry is far from an enslaved nation. Israel is a strong, courageous, dynamic, creative nation. We have great advantages our ancient predecessors couldn't have dreamed of. And with their example as our inspiration, we too can work to build on our tremendous history and invigorate the Jewish world and our larger world in powerful and positive ways. To play us in on Too Jewish this morning, for no particular reason, here's an upbeat Yiddish song called, well, Borscht. It's kind of Eastern European love song, if you will. And it's, of course, slightly tragic.
Ich hab noch a Borscht nicht gegessen, und ich hab noch a Tome nicht gefühlt. Ich kann dir mein Leben nicht vergessen, weil ich hab da geliebt. Ich kann dir mein Leben nicht vergessen, weil ich hab da geliebt. Und ich bin mir ein Ball, der ein Gebäudener, Das ganze Städtel keine Sache in mir, nur der Herr bin ich geworden, verloren, weil ich hab da geliebt. Der Herr bin ich geworden, verloren, weil ich hab da geliebt. Mein Mami verkäufen die Schieb Und ich will dir dem Norden erzählen Weil ich hab da lieb Ich will dir dem Norden erzählen Weil ich hab da lieb Tomer geht es dir nicht es Ist mein Seite gewesen na Sene ulm, weil ich wünschen alle deine Gruppe. Komm mal mir bei dir, komm mal sene ulm, weil ich wünschen alle deine Gruppe. Vergessen, weil ich hab da geliebt. Ich kann dir mein Leben nicht mich vergessen, wenn im Zugewiesen viele Sterne gerieb.
That was the song Borscht in Yiddish, which brings me to our guest this morning, who is very much taken with a Yiddish word. Our guest is U.S. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, author of a new book called It Takes Chutzpah. He defines it in a very special way. Find out how and why he values chutzpah so highly when he joins us as we return in a moment on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Senator Ron Wyden, the second-ranking senator in the entire Senate for a while, has written a new book. It's called It Takes Chutzpah, How to Fight Fearlessly for Progressive Change. Senator Wyden's had a distinguished career. I don't know, does that make you feel old when people say that?
Well, my older daughter said the other day, she said, Dad, I've been watching some of the hearings and discussions on C-SPAN, and Dad, let me tell you, I've decided you're in the only profession on earth where somebody your age is still considered kind of young.
Have we become like a gerontocracy or something here? It's very strange, isn't it?
I think everybody understands the demographics, but you know, I still think if you had the founding fathers in a debate like this, they'd say, let's think about the age of the ideas, folks. You know, that's what we're talking about. And that's why I'm focused on making the case for using more chutzpah, because we need some fresh ideas and we've got some big, big challenges. And it's not just AI and what you read about in the paper, but lots and lots of big challenges, and you're not going to be able to resolve them all unless we kind of build on what is sort of in our DNA, which is chutzpah, and the other side of the coin, tikkun olam.
So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, the famous joke is chutzpah is the guy who kills his parents, throws himself on the mercy of the court because he's an orphan. But you don't mean it in a negative way. Tell us when this word became important to you.
The book goes through some of the rabbinical history in terms of chutzpah and how it came about and bad chutzpah, good chutzpah, and the like. But let me try to put it in straightforward terms. I believe that chutzpah is inherently good, and it's really part of our DNA. I mean, the founding fathers basically showed their chutzpah when they told the British to go fly a kite. So chutzpah is inherently good, and what I contrast chutzpah that's good with is chutzpah that is warped or misappropriated it. And sometimes I have felt that that has been clearly the case with Donald Trump.
So in the Senate, there must be a lot of chutzpah on display on a regular basis, no?
Chutzpah in the Senate to a lot of people might come off as just being loud. And that's not what we want to portray. What we want to portray is people who are willing to reach across the aisle and say, you have a good idea. I think we have a good idea. Let's try to find some common ground. That's what I did in the part of the book that describes how I broke 50 years worth of gridlock on climate change. Literally for 50 years, there had been nothing done on cap and trade or carbon pricing. And I basically said to my colleagues, we need to lower the amount of carbon in our country, but we also need to hold down electric prices. And that was appealing to both Democrats and Republicans as we talked through the issues, and was fundamentally considered chutzpah that is inherently good.
We will talk much more with Senator Ron Wyden about chutzpah and where he got it from in his own family when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter and spring. Established 6 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. with services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can come to services on our Facebook page. It's BeitSimcha Tucson. Our very musical services are available in person and virtually. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. You can access those. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the most dynamic and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments are a big help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, Tom, we're right around the time of International Holocaust Remembrance Day now. There has been a troubling, I think, frankly, disturbing rise of the far right in a variety of countries, in Germany, in France, in Italy, and many of the people involved, certainly Hungary for a long time, many of the people involved are not just right-wing, but they're obvious and open anti-Semites. What's going on? Where does this come from right now?
Well, it's a good question, and I guess it's a counterbalance to last week's conversation about the growing and like increasingly out of the closet Jewish community in Montenegro.
Right.
That's counterbalanced by communities that are either leaving or more fearful or living more shuttered lives as communities in countries where the right wing has come to power or plays an increasingly large and threatening role. So, interesting landmark, just in the past few days, Jean-Marie Le Pen died. He's the father of the current Marine Le Pen, who leads the far-right party founded by her father, who was an unrepentant racist, anti-Semite, neo-Nazi, call him what you want, but that was his whole career was that. So I see that as the beating heart of Europe because on the one hand, France was always this citadel of human rights and tolerance and multi-ethnicity.
The first country to pass, you know, that kind of a national statement of individual rights.
Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Thank you. I knew you would remember the name.
You know, in some ways, as France goes, so goes Europe. So,
and the French certainly believe that. So.
So in Germany, you have a growing presence of immigrants who are visibly different and who are confessionally, religiously different. There's a lot of Muslim immigrants that makes many Germans uncomfortable.
A lot of Turks, for example.
Among others. And the far-right party is doing frighteningly well in many polls and local and regional elections. They haven't put anybody in national power yet, but they look like well on their way to doing that.
Right. Actually, in Austria, the far-right party just took power.
Right, but Austria is such a small country.
Less significant,
right.
Sure.
In Italy, the far-right has been in charge for a while. Giorgia Meloni, one of the most powerful politicians in Europe, and while she is not herself overtly anti-Semitic, her party certainly is. And Italy has a history of anti-Semitism under Mussolini. Now, was that totally imposed by the Germans or did it strike a resonant chord in the Italian soul? I fear the latter might be true. And Hungary for a long time has been in the hands of a right-wing nutcase, Orban.
Viktor Orban.
Who is also part of a long Hungarian tradition of anti-Semitism. So, you know, as much as there may be bright spots in certain places where Jewish communities are resurrecting themselves, like in Sicily or Andalusia, whatever, on a national level in Europe, a lot of people are looking for, like, ways to bail. Now, if you take two of the largest Jewish communities in Europe, Russia and Ukraine, it's not so much a rise in anti-Semitism that is causing Jews to leave or think about leaving. It is fear that their draft age children will become cannon fodder in this absurd and criminal conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And to protect their kids, people are looking into options. And one of the options, as hard as it may be to believe under the current set of circumstances, one of the options that's attractive to them is Israel.
Yeah, it's kind of stunning. I mean, that's why Israel was created to some degree, that it was the place Jews would always be able to go. That's what the law of return is all about.
Kibbutz Galuyot.
Yeah, Kibbutz Galuyot. And in this case, it's serving as that function even in the midst of wartime.
Yep.
Thanks so much, Tom. We will talk next week.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. This one in honor of our guest this morning, Senator Ron Wyden and his new book. An old Jewish Bubby limps onto a crowded bus. Standing in front of a seated young man, she clutches her chest and says, "Oy, if you only knew what I have, you'd get up and give me your seat." The guy looks at the woman reluctantly, gives up his seat. The old woman sitting beside the bubby takes out a fan and starts to fan herself. Grasping her chest, the old bubby turns and says, "If you only knew what I have, you would give me that fan." And the woman gives her the fan reluctantly. 15 minutes later, the bubby gets up, says to the bus driver, "Stop! I need to get off here." The driver says, "Sorry, lady, the bus stops at the next corner. I can't stop in the middle of the block." Again, the old woman clutches her chest and says, "If you knew what I have, you would let me out right here." Worried, the bus driver pulls over, lets her out in the middle of the block. As she's climbing down the stairs, though, he asks, "Ma'am, what is it exactly that you have?" The old bubby looks up, smiles sweetly at him, and says, "Chutzpah." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Two Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. Not sure Senator Wyden would agree with that use of the word chutzpah. And now a word of Torah. This week, our people gets out of Egypt. Or to be more accurate, we chant the Torah portion of Bo, which includes the description of the actual exodus from Egyptian slavery and the establishment of the rites and rituals of the observance of the Passover. The build-up to this week's Parsha has been steady and dramatic. Plague follows plague, 10 of them, of course, rising in severity as the one God overcomes the long roster of Egyptian gods, idols, and frees the people of Israel from their long night of oppression and slavery. Finally, in Bo, our ancestors become a truly free people. Well, since we are now free, you might expect us to immediately cast off the memory of oppression and enslavement and move on to new and better things, to reject our history of degradation. But oddly, God, through Moses, commands us to do quite the opposite. To remember the slavery, how we were freed only by God's great acts. And from this point on, we are reminded repeatedly in the Torah to remember those in our own society who are oppressed, to help them. Because after all, we ourselves were slaves in the land of Egypt. You were strangers in a strange land, we tell ourselves. Help the strangers in your land. The message is powerful in its own way. We are to recall the fact of our own oppression, so that we will identify with those in our world who need our help. The portion of Bo teaches us that we must always seek to redeem the world through our own actions. Our connection is with the lowly. Our efforts to heal the world come from the knowledge that we ourselves have come up from exactly that background. It's a powerful lesson in humility that leads directly to Jewish charity, tzedakah, and the promulgation of righteousness in the world. May we all remember that lesson this week and every week. There's a further lesson in Bo. Remember the Exodus. Well, that's not just a call to social action. After the final plague is inflicted on Pharaoh and the Egyptians, and the Israelites are freed from slavery, they escape towards the shore of the Sea of Reeds. As their great ancestor Joseph asked, they carry with them on their journey an ark containing his bones. It is symbolic of the new life and liberation our people are seeking, emblematic as well of the fact that we always carry our own past with us. Our history, for better or worse, comes with us throughout our lives. When we are able to transform that personal history, as our ancestors did, collectively, from slavery to freedom, from the bondage of the snares of the past to the freedom to create a new, better, holier reality, well, then we can achieve the promise of a future of goodness, blessing, and life. When we come back in a moment on Two Jewish, our guest, Senator Ron Wyden, explains how his work in politics has been fueled by that most Jewish of all qualities. His new book is called It Takes Chutzpah. Find out what it means to fight fearlessly for progressive change in a Jewish way, as Senator Wyden does, when we return in a moment right here on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The first three Israeli hostages were released under the ceasefire agreement with Hamas, having been imprisoned under Gaza by the Palestinian terrorists for over 15 months. 90 Palestinian terrorist prisoners held by Israel were simultaneously released, a ratio of 30 to 1, which should give some idea of the relative value Israel places on its citizens' lives as opposed to Hamas. Three female hostages, Emily Damari, Romy Gonen, and Doran Steinbrecher, were finally released by Hamas Palestinian terrorists to the custody of the Red Cross, who transferred them to Israeli authorities last week. They were welcomed by their mothers, who did not see them for 471 days, and taken for medical treatment at the Sheba Medical Center. We will continue to hope that the remaining Israeli hostages will be released under the agreement, as will the bodies of murdered Israelis, sickeningly still held by Hamas Palestinian terrorists. In other news, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu came to the defense of Elon Musk days after the billionaire and richest man in the world and prominent Trump ally was accused of delivering Nazi salutes at a presidential inauguration rally. Not just accused, you can see the pictures. An hour afterwards, the world's richest man was cracking Holocaust jokes on social media. Elon Musk is being falsely smeared, Netanyahu wrote on X, Musk's own social media account. He avoided addressing Musk's Nazi salute gestures directly, but went on to call the tech mogul a great friend of Israel. Netanyahu pointed to Musk's visiting Israel after the October 7, 2023 Hamas atrocities and advocating for what he said was Israel's right to defend itself against genocidal terrorists and regimes who seek to annihilate the one and only Jewish state. Those were Musk's words back then. Israeli Prime Minister, who remains in the political hot seat after agreeing to the tenuous ceasefire and hostage release agreement with Hamas, concluded, "I thank him for this." Musk, in turn, thanked him and then fanned the flame shortly afterwards, as he is wont to do, with a new post on X. "Don't say Hess to Nazi accusations. Some people will Goebbels anything down. Stop goring your enemies." His pronouns would have been he, Himmler. "Bet you did not see that coming," Musk posted, adding laughing face emojis. Musk's post earned reprobation from Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, which days earlier failed to criticize Musk's hand gestures, saying it was perhaps not a Nazi symbol. "We've said it hundreds of times before," Greenblatt posted on X. "The Holocaust was a singularly evil event, and it is inappropriate and offensive to make light of it." Addressing Musk, Greenblatt added, "The Holocaust is not a joke." But Greenblatt's own account was silent earlier in the week when Musk's hand gestures came out. He refrained from commenting on Musk during a panel on anti-Semitism at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. The ADL did not respond to questions about why the post was denounced, but the hand gestures weren't. Ted Deutsch, CEO of the American Jewish Committee, denounced Musk's jokes in stronger terms. "Wordplay about Nazis isn't funny, it isn't clever, and it's dangerous," Deutsch wrote on X. Addressing Musk, he added, "However you feel about the accusations being made against you, this is absolutely the wrong response. Nazi-themed jokes are offensive and harmful. Don't belittle the seriousness of the Holocaust. You give cover to those who seek to do the same." Linda Yaccarino, X's CEO, also responded to Musk's jokes with a laughing face emoji. She, of course, was hired by Musk and had pledged to curb anti-Semitism on the platform in the past. Netanyahu's own vote of approval came after the Tesla CEO delivered two outstretched arm salute motions to a cheering crowd following Trump's swearing in. Jewish groups and Democrats accused Musk, who has a history of engaging with white supremacists, of performing an unambiguous Nazi salute. The accusations themselves have real-world repercussions. In Milwaukee, a meteorologist for a CBS affiliate TV station was fired after she wrote in a profane post on her personal Instagram account that Musk Nazi saluted twice, and she got fired. Protesters have seized on the charge. In Germany, an image of Musk's raised arm with the word Heil was projected on the side of a Tesla plant. In Italy, a leftist student group hung an effigy of Musk on the Milan site where fascist Prime Minister Benito Mussolini was hanged in 1945. Before his run of Nazi jokes, Musk, who now heads a U.S. government efficiency program under Trump, responded to the controversy by, of course, attacking his critics. "The radical leftists are really upset that they had to take time out of their busy day praising Hamas to call me a Nazi," he wrote on X in a post that Netanyahu shared. The post echoed a growing pro-Israel talking point that Musk's critics are hypocrites for excusing anti-Semitism on the pro-Palestinian left. "Look, here on Too Jewish, we don't like anti-Semitism on either side. Nazi salutes and Nazi jokes, coming from the right are just as disgusting as they are from the left. And a survivor of the Nova Music Festival massacre will represent Israel in the 2025 Eurovision Song Contest. Yuval Rafael secured the position last week when she won Rising Star. Kochav Nolad, I think, the Israeli TV show that produces each year's Eurovision entrant through a combination of professional judges and public voting. Rafael beat out three other finalists, including the Christian Arab Valerie Hamati and Daniel Weiss, whose father was murdered by the Hamas terrorists on October 7, 2023, his mother abducted and later killed in Gaza by Hamas Palestinian terrorists. Yuval Rafael's win was propelled in part by her soulful rendition of ABBA's Dancing Queen. The lyric, "You can dance," echoes the Nova Survivor Movement's mantra, "We will dance again." Rafael will perform in Basel, Switzerland in May in the international competition that last year drew fierce protest over Israel's participation because of the Israel-Hamas war. Israel's song for the competition, Hurricane, which last year had to be reworked when the competition's organizers deemed the lyrics overly political, will be selected later this spring. Competition falls a year after Rafael testified in front of the UN Human Rights Council about her experience October 7th when Hamas launched its war with its terrible attack on Israel, killing about 1,200 people, a third of them at the Nova Festival. She described piling into a bomb shelter with dozens of other festival goers as terrorists assaulted them. "When the bodies of the murdered fell on us, I understood hiding under them was the only way I could survive this nightmare," she testified. Of the 51 people in the shelter with her, she said, 40 were murdered that day. She added, "The physical injuries I sustained are healing, but the mental scars will stay with me forever." Rafael launched her singing career after the attack, has been in music workshops for festival survivors. She said before her performance on the competition that she wanted to bring her story to Basel. "I want to tell them the story of our country, of what I went through, of what others went through," she said. "I want to tell the story, but not from a place of seeking pity. I want it to be from a place of standing strong in the face of this, in the face of the booze I'm 100% sure will come from the crowd." And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Senator Ron Wyden has a long and distinguished record in the U.S. Senate, where he's accomplished a great deal. But most important for us, he has a new book out about chutzpah, how to fight fearlessly for progressive change. Ron, tell us, in your family, where did the chutzpah come from?
Well, my parents certainly demonstrated it. My mother, who I dedicate the book to, deserves enormous credit, because when all the Jews were thinking or talking about Hitler in Germany in the 30s, the men refused to look at the facts that Hitler was a devastatingly evil force. They, particularly the men, thought he was kind of a crackpot and he would go away. And my mother basically took them all on. She had gotten a master's degree from Yale and was a real student, and she said, "You're missing this. He's going to kill and kill and kill some more." And I dedicate the book, the very first page, to my mom, because she had the chutzpah to recognize how serious it is. I read it. "The memory of my mom Edith, my grandmother Helen, and all the strong Jewish women in Germany in the 1930s who saw clearly the Nazi threat, so badly underestimated by their husbands and sons. Without them and their courage, I wouldn't be here to write this book. And the most important women in my life, Lily, Ava, and Scarlett, they're my daughters, who make me cavil every day, and especially Nancy, that's my wife, whose love and strength is my constant inspiration." That is the in action.
That's beautiful. It's also Tikkun Olam. You like to balance those principles really throughout the book, as you mentioned earlier. You've been in the Senate since 1996. You were in the U.S. House. You've been in basically national government since 1981. Can you explain what changes you've seen and why chutzpah is crucial to countering them?
Well, what's happened is both political parties, to some extent, have retreated to their own. When I came to the Senate in 1996, essentially there were 11 or 12 moderate Republicans, and Democrats would always look for them. That has vanished. Now there's only a handful of them. And the challenge is to invite principled bipartisanship. In other words, partisanship can just be plain old credit-taking. In other words, it's not related to trying to solve problems. It can also be ideological, which is also related to taking credit. What I'm for is principled bipartisanship. That was the example I gave you of how we broke the gridlock on
climate change
and carbon by saying that we could cut carbon in our country and we could hold down electric prices. Let me also kind of give you one other bit of phrasing from another important voice, and that is Rabbi Freeman, the editor from Chabad, wrote at one point, to be a good Jew, you need two opposites, a sense of shame that prevents you from acting with chutzpah to do the wrong thing, and a sense of chutzpah that prevents you from being ashamed to do the right thing. And we basically say those are the dueling impulses that drive Jewry.
I want to ask you a difficult question. You talk about progressive change. The progressive movement has come out strongly in many ways against many of Israel's actions, and at times has accepted anti-Semitic tropes and stereotypes. How do you respond to people that question progressivism now?
First of all, let's understand how I'm taking progressive change. I really use the word progressive as an antidote to being regressive or looking backwards. It is not just solely something that has been part of this taking up arms of political battle in America. As far as my position on Israel is concerned, I have said now for a number of years that our relationship as a country with Israel is special, and I will never turn my back on that special relationship because I disagree with a leader of Israel as I do now in Benjamin Netanyahu.
In the course of talking about what it means to you, what Tikkun Olam means to you, that is the goal of perfecting the world, b'malchut shaddai, under the kingdom of God, according to the traditional formulation. Can you give some examples of that you use in the book, but also outside of that, of ways in which you...
My work with the elderly, which I began when I was 29.
Right, right. The Grey Panthers. It was with the Grey Panthers, right?
I was the founder of the Oregon Grey Panthers, was in fact what I consider the best of using your chutzpah to perfect the world. Back then, if the town had a lunch program for the elderly people, that was considered a big deal. Not like today where there are millions in AARP. They promise discounts and flights and various other kinds of things. And it was tremendously satisfying. You know, we watched senior citizens who had been ripped off by fast-talking insurance agents who had bought policies that weren't worth the paper they were written on, show that they could be political activists and to speak out and to stop the insurance companies from pillaging their finances. And that was enormously satisfying. It's still one of the major concerns I pursue as a senator on the Senate Finance Committee, where I'm a senior Democrat. We have jurisdiction over Medicare, Medicaid, and health services, and I focus strongly on the needs of the elders to this day.
In the course of your book, you talk about good chutzpah and something that you define as not good. I don't know if you would still call it chutzpah, but I think most of us would, which is just nerve, right? Gall. How do you distinguish within yourself when it's for good and when it's just chutzpah?
Well, you don't really have a lot of trouble making the distinction. When you see someone does it and uses bad chutzpah, you'll find a lot of people looking disgusted, maybe even revolted, and they'll look and say that's not proper. When Donald Trump made fun of the disabled journalist some years ago, that was the kind of feeling it generated, that that's not what a leader does.
It's kind of a smell test then, isn't it?
In a lot of ways, it is a a test of heart. What does your heart tell you? Because chutzpah is inherently good. And as the rabbis like Passover and other holidays to discuss matters and how we can be better, it's about the heart to a great extent.
We're in a difficult period, I think, for people who respect chutzpah done for the greater good as opposed to just splashing their egos around everywhere.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm amazed at how many people still don't know what chutzpah is. I have started trying to get out and explain the book, and a couple of days ago, I was in New York. My wife owns the Strand Bookstore, one of the great bookstores in America.
It is.
And someone had gotten the galleys, a young person, and said, "Hey, you're the basketball guy, right? You know, a guy who was a ball player back in the day?" I said, "Yeah, that's me." And he goes, "That's cool. I'm looking at this book. Tell me all about hoopla." And somehow basketball and chutzpah had been commingled just in the pronunciation.
I love that. You know, basketball used to be a Jewish sport.
Oh, yeah. We had people like Dolph Shays. We had all kinds of people.
In dealing with an era in which progressive, in the definition that you use, is the progressive party, and in which a lot of the ideals that you stand for are going to be in the minority, how do you demonstrate chutzpah in a productive way? I remember asking Rabbi David Saperstein, an old friend.
Rabbi David Saperstein wrote something very nice for the back of the book.
He sure did.
He's a wonderful man.
He's a great guy. He's a good friend. And I remember when I was in rabbinical school to talk about the work of the Religious Action Center at a time when Republicans were controlling everything in Congress and the president was Republican, and it didn't seem like they were getting anything done. I said, like, how do you deal with that, you know, and what's the purpose? And he said, oh, you have no idea how much work we do behind the scenes to soften things, to change things, and we work with everybody. Do you think that's right?
Well, I think that rabbis personify the sense of inclusiveness, reaching out, making sure that there is an opportunity for all who wish to be heard to be heard. And I think that's one of the best qualities of Judaism, is that we like to have discussions and sort of, as people used to say, kick around some ideas and find some common ground rather than just have one person say, this is the way it'll be. It's such a waste of chutzpah talent.
What word would you use for the bad form of chutzpah? Because it's not chutzpah, according to you.
Malice, ugliness, unfairness.
What was the most difficult thing for you in writing It Takes Chutzpah?
Well, I constantly wanted to write a book that wasn't a typical political book. Because political books usually go something like this. Congress critter decides that they will tell everyone willing to listen how incredibly skilled they are and what a terrific legislator they are and all the bills that they passed and all the great things they've done. So the bragging section is pretty long and extensive. Then there's another section where the elected official is being urged by many people to run for president, and he is basically holding them off with the whip and some chairs because he's being persuaded to do it. And he kind of feigns interest and pretends to not be interested, even though he's cultivated the whole thing. And then third, you really find that he's looking for a way to wrap up. And very often, he tells everyone, because the outcry for his candidacy has been so great, he's had to form a presidential exploratory committee. And he lists the 35 websites that you can use to contribute to his campaign. I wanted no part of that.
You know, I think this is the first genuinely political book that I can think of that's about politics, really, that's so Jewish in its flavor. I know Joe Lieberman has, Joe Lieberman, may rest in peace, wrote some books about Shabbat and so on, but this is really about what it takes to succeed, and you explore Bereishit, you talk about one of my favorite stories, Abraham arguing with God and the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. You refer to Gemara and Mishnah, Talmud. What's your favorite part of the book?
My favorite part of the book, of course, are the rules, because the rules give us a chance to take our enduring chutzpah, and everybody's got chutzpah, and use the rules to polish it up and then go forth and use it. So the rules are my favorite part. I especially like the playing the long game, because I think everything today with social media and the internet is all based on trying to do everything as quickly as possible, which often generates little or no thought. And playing the long game means that you're thinking more about what the real issues are.
I want to thank Senator Ron Wyden for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called It Takes Chutzpah, and it's a great read. Where can people find out more about the book and of course, about you?
Well, you can find out a lot online. There are many websites that are selling the book. You can find out about me at wyden.senate.gov in terms of my Senate record. My political side is a scene in Stand Tall for America. That is our political site. But you will have no problem seeing a cascade of sites about me online. And I'm so thrilled to have a chance to be on your program. I've heard such good things about it. And I hope to be there and meet you all in person and have a program taped on site.
I would love to. I was told we have to invite you to come speak at Shabbat services too. So just at lunch today. So come visit. We'd love to have you.
Where are you, in Tucson?
Tucson, Arizona. That's correct. Another good basketball town, I might add.
It is a good basketball town. It's got a real history. All right. Big thanks. Look forward to staying in touch.
Our pleasure, and thank you for elevating chutzpah as you have done. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Sally Poulat, representing Leket Israel, the Israeli food bank. It received the 2024 Kohan Memorial Foundation for service to Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, recently. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from a group with the appropriate name of Chutzpah. I mean, what a great way to end this show, right? It's a hip-hop number called Ask the Rabbi. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Yo, we're pouring the Chevets, popping the credits. I'm singing a hit, so I'm rhyming the rituals. You love what I did, so I make it official. Tav's on the mic for schnitzel, my nitzel. Rosh Hashanah starts off the new year conception. Listen up, you hear? What? It's a high holy day that the Lord chose to say, let there be light, cause I like it that way. If you don't believe me, just check it and you'll see. Ask the rabbi.
Yeah.
Just listen to the rabbi.
Yeah.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.